Next up, we have Patel versus Simmons Bank. And we'll just wait till the courtroom clears before we begin.
May it please the court. I'm Lawrence Metch. I'm the counsel for the appellant, Larissa Patel. And we seek review of the district court's order on cross motions for summary judgment entered in favor of the appellee Simmons Bank. The district court's order is electronically published at 2018 Westlaw 1449400. If the court will allow me on a personal note, 47 years ago, I was employed as a law clerk for this court, Judge Brian Simpson in Jacksonville, Florida. And here I am 47 years later. I'm privileged as I was then to serve this court, now to argue in this court. I really appreciate this opportunity, and thank you. Ms. Patel's father, Mr. Bansahar Kalidis Patel, died on June 5th, 2016, while he was on a business trip to India. At his death, he left a real mess. He owned 55% interest in a limited liability company in South Carolina called Aiken Hospitality Group, LLC. Aiken Hospitality Group, LLC owned and operated a Comfort Inn and Suites Hotel in Aiken, South Carolina.
Counsel, I think we've got the basic facts, if you would get into your analysis or argument and reasons.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it.
You don't contest that Tennessee law applies, right?
Well, it depends which claim we're talking about. We actually pleaded that Tennessee law applies to count one of our cross claim, which is for the policy proceeds. With respect to count two of our cross claim, we contend that South Carolina law applies, and that's the subrogation claim that we make. And that mirrors, we believe, a portion of the loan agreement to which my client was not a party, but section 8.4 of the loan agreement between Simmons Bank's predecessor and AHG recognized that both states' laws would apply. It says this agreement will be governed by, construed, and enforced in accordance with federal law and the laws of the state of Tennessee, except and only to the extent of procedural matters related to the perfection and enforcement of lenders' rights and remedies against the property, which is in South Carolina, which matters shall be governed by the laws of the state of South Carolina. So the loan agreement itself, which, of course, my client did not sign, she was just the beneficiary under the policy, contemplated two different bodies of substantive law applicable to this loan. One was Tennessee, and that was because the predecessor to Simmons Bank was the First State Bank, which is a Tennessee bank. Simmons Bank is really not a Tennessee bank, it's an Arkansas bank, and it acquired First State Bank after the death of Mr. Patel. So as I mentioned, we have a situation in which we contend that with respect to count one of our cross claim for the policy proceeds, which were interpleaded and are now in the hands of the district court clerk, the $1 million is still there.
On your policy proceeds, you've got confronting you 56.7204 of the Tennessee Code, which says that the rights and interests of the beneficiary, including a child of the insured, shall be subject and subordinate to the rights and interest of the assignee. That seems pretty clear.
Well, we have a challenge to that, Your Honor. Our position is that the statute, if you go down to subsection B3, actually codifies the holding in Third National Bank versus Hall. So if you look at the language of that, it says that it codifies the existing rights under assignments of insurance policy. Well, under Third National Bank versus Hall, we contend that that's a black cow case, a spotted cow case, sorry, Your Honor, that it deals exactly with our situation, where at the time of his death, the obligor...
You can rely on the notes all you want to, but the plain language of the statute, which has been on the books for, 56 years, the rights and interests of the beneficiary, including a child, shall be subject and subordinate to the rights and interests of the assignee.
Well, it's correct. We don't challenge the validity of the assignment, not at all. All we're saying is that that statute did not overrule the decision in Third National Bank of Hull. And there is no...
It does to the extent that that decision is inconsistent with the plain language of the statute.
Well, we would disagree with that, and we would cite, Your Honor, to...
So if there's a statute directly on point that says anybody named Patel loses...
I would probably agree with that. If it came to that close, we might have a bill of attainder at that point, but it would still, I would agree with that.
But only if the cow's got more spots in the statute than it does in the case, right?
Well, this court encountered the same problem with the different context in Global Quest, which we cite in our brief. And the other question was whether the enactment of the Uniform Commercial Code in Florida had overruled a 1942 Florida Supreme Court decision, and this court came back and said, no, it had not overruled that. And we have the same situation here. There's not a single Tennessee case which has ever hinted that Third National Bank versus Hall has been overruled. In fact...
But it does seem that Third National Bank, even if it's not been overruled, is distinguishable. I mean, there what happened was the decedent did not make his intent clear about whether he intended for his debts to be paid first by the proceeds of his stock trading or the proceeds of his life insurance policy. But here, we do have the loan agreement that seems to make the intent clear.
Well, we would disagree with that because the fact of the matter is that he died without a will. All he did was make a collateral assignment. In the event that there was a default, then the million-dollar policy, assuming that he died and the money was available, would go towards paying down the loan. The fact is, there is no default. It never has been a default, and the bank is here seeking an effective prepayment on the $4 million loan. And indeed, after Mr. Patel's...
He didn't say in the assignment. The assignment didn't say only in the event of a default, did it?
Well, as far as we're concerned, that's the only sensible way that you can interpret the loan agreement.
No, but it didn't say that.
No, the assignment was a form that was provided by the Pruco, the Prudential Company, and it was a collateral assignment. And we infer from that it's collateral to what? It's collateral designed to protect the obligee in the event of a default. Indeed, after Mr. Patel died, the bank advanced additional funds to the limited liability company, so it could buy additional bedroom furniture and continue its operations. So to this day, and the district court's opinion reflects that, there has been no declaration of default, whatever. So what we have here is the anomalous situation where the bank is trying to have its cake and eat it too. They want to get a payment down, $1 million down, and they want to continue to receive income on interest payments on the remainder of the loan. A collateral assignment is not designed to deal with that situation. It's designed to deal with the prospect of a default by the obligor. Indeed,
of course, it doesn't say in the case of a default, but let me ask you this.
Right.
What's your position on what the language of the collateral assignment as its, his, or her interest may appear?
Well, we think that has to do with the situation of what are we talking about as far as the status of the loan at the time. As we concede, and we pointed out, that the death of the obligor, of the guarantor, Mr. Patel, what could have been an eventual default under the loan agreement. Indeed, it says that. But the bank decided to waive that and continue to do business with the LLC and indeed advanced additional loan proceeds after the death of Mr. Patel. So that language is very classic old language that you see in assignments, but it had nothing to do with Third National Bank versus Hall. If Mr. Patel had left a will in which he had specified that the proceeds of the policy were to be used initially to pay down the loan in the event of his death, I wouldn't be here today. I wouldn't have a case. But he didn't do that. He didn't sign any other document to say that to that effect as well. And that also carries over to the subrogation claim that we have. In the subrogation claim, the South Carolina decision upon which we rely says that it's incumbent upon, in order for subrogation to be defeated, you have to have some statement, a clear, explicit statement from the insured that it was his intention that there'd be no subrogation rights flowing to the beneficiary. So obviously I'm here today hoping that we could get the policy proceeds which are in the court, but if we can't, I've had in count two of the cross claim we're asking for the right of subrogation, that of the $4 million that is owed. The loan would be paid down, as far as, at least as far as the bank is concerned, $3 million, so it would leave $1 million due and owing, because the limited liability company is not entitled to a windfall. Indeed, the South Carolina court said that in its opinion in the case we cite, which is Falk versus Freeland. So they're not entitled to a windfall. We're entitled to stand in the place of the bank to the extent of the amount of policy proceeds that were taken by the bank. Indeed, we cite cases from all over the country dealing with count two of our cross-claim, which point out that under these circumstances, in the absence of a specific directive from the insured, of course, by the time all this occurs, he or she is gone, but there's nothing in this record that shows that at any time that Mr. Patel directed that there be no subrogation permitted. And so the presumption under South Carolina law, New York law, Indiana law, all the law that we cite is that there's a presumption in favor of subrogation.
Thank you
very much.
Chief, did you have anything else?
No.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Good morning, Catherine Ender from Cole, Scott & Cassane on behalf of Simmons Bank. And as a personal note, I'm glad to see a fellow Cartian in the courtroom today. Don't see that very often. We are requesting that the court affirm on all grounds. There was a stipulation of fact in the underlying record, so the only questions that are issue here are whether the statute in Tennessee code applies and whether they're entitled to equitable subrogation. The court seems to understand this. The first claim is supported by Tennessee law. The statute.
Let me ask you, is there any Tennessee case out there at all that imposes a condition precedent such as a default?
No, Your Honor, not that I have found. And in fact, if you look at the Hall decision, and this was a question that Judge Rosenbaum presented, first of all, it's a question of intent. And the documents clearly establish intent here. But the Hall decision, whether it was overruled or just not applicable, if you look at it, the Hall decision deals with a priority of collateral cases and a priority of assign of who receives the benefits. And in that case, there was enough benefits paid out by the stock options that the beneficiaries under the policy ultimately ended up getting a portion of the insurance policy benefits. We don't have a similar situation here. The issue in this case is clearly intent, and what was intended under the life insurance policy, the subsequent loan agreement, which clearly intended to assign the rights to Simmons Bank. And there's no intent otherwise. The decedent died intestate, so there is no will. In addition, I wanted to point out that all of the cases that are cited by Patel in this case go to the trustee of the estate or the executor of the estate, not to a third-party bank who's simply receiving the proceeds as the assignee of a life insurance policy. So we have an instance here where they're attempting to make arguments as to the facial validity of an assignment, facial validity of a loan agreement, to basically an innocent third party that's just attempting to collect as is their right pursuant to the agreements and the intent of the decedent.
Let me ask you this. Just to make sure we're all on board on this. This assignment, they're entitled to collect on, your bank's entitled to collect on only to the extent of the mortgage. In other words, if there'd been $100,000 left in the mortgage, they couldn't have collected on the entire life insurance proceeds, could they?
Correct, Your Honor, that would be our position. And in that case, that may very well apply to the Hall case where there's a priority of where the proceeds go. The mortgage would be satisfied to the amount of the $100,000, and then the remainder may go to the beneficiary in that case. But in this case, we have an instance where the assignee takes priority over the beneficiary. It was the clear intention of the decedent. There's nothing to the contrary that's been stipulated to in the record, and there's no case law that would support anything otherwise.
Yeah, and just again, so we get the bigger picture, and attorneys are probably assuming that all this, but the idea behind this kind of assignment of life insurance proceeds is not any kind of viatical arrangement where the bank's gambling on the guy's life, but is the theory is that as long as he's alive and well, they think they can get repaid. But this covers them in case he as the key man is no longer alive and well.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think our only other point that I would make right now, if the court has no further questions, is that the subrogation argument is missing several prongs. There was no payment to be subrogated to. And notwithstanding that, again, they're bringing this action against essentially an innocent third party and not an executor of the estate, not a trustee of the estate, not the estate itself. And the subrogation action wouldn't be appropriate, whether it be under Tennessee law or South Carolina law, pursuant to the cases that they even cite. If the court has no further questions for me, then we would rest on our briefs and request that you affirm on all grounds. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Chief, did you have anything?
No, thank you.
Well, we have a situation here, again, with I understand from the Chief Judge's questions that the primary concern has to do with the impact of the statute on this, on the relationship between the insurance policy and the underlying loan obligation. I would just like to point out that in the case that's cited by the bank, it's called In re Prodigo, which is the which is a bankruptcy court case from Tennessee. The bankruptcy judge there actually cited not only the statute, but Third National Bank versus Hall in the same string citation. So our contention is that this is indeed a priority of distribution of policy proceeds case. Well, I'm fully aware of the language that appears in the assignment. I'm also, I'm asking the court to pay attention, please, to the Third National Bank versus Hall. And there has been not a single utterance from the Tennessee courts in all the years since then. There is one case that came out 1 year later after Third National Bank of Hall, which was the Supreme Court of Tennessee, which adopted the same doctrine. It's called Twinham. It's mentioned in our brief. And in Twinham, the deceased had actually left specific instructions in his will that the policy proceeds were to be used to be paid down, initially to pay down the amount of the debt. Of course, there's no such will here, and there's no such other document as well. And with respect to subrogation, this is the classic type of subrogation that if, in fact, subrogation is denied, it means that, denied to Ms. Patel, it means that the obligor, the Aiken Hospitality Group, will be getting a windfall to the expect of $1 million. My client is actually standing in the shoes of her father, who was a guarantor, and if he had paid the $1 million out of his own funds, he would have been entitled to subrogation. So the case law extends that also to the notion of life insurance policy, and the cases we cite deal with the exact same situation. But for him taking out the life insurance policy and then dying, there would be no $1 million available.
So is there anything in the record about where the hotel, the equity in the hotel, if any, went?
Well, it's still there. It's an operating hotel. It's
there. Well, I mean, who owns the equity in the hotel?
Well, at the time of his death, Mr. Patel owned 55%. So that's now in the hands of his estate, which is being administered in Richmond County, Augusta, Georgia.
Including, I assume, his daughter?
Well, my client, his daughter, would be a 50% residual beneficiary of that estate. The problem with that is that the bank holds a $4 million unsecured claim in that estate. In addition, although it's not in the record, there were other very significant debts that Mr. Patel had at the time of his death.
Yeah, but my point is paying off the mortgage to the extent that this assignment did benefited your client as a maybe indirectly, and maybe she didn't end up getting the benefit of it because by the time everything shakes out, there's nothing left. But it increases either the equity share of the estate in the hotel or at least increases the chance that there'll be something left over, right?
Well, there's a theoretical possibility. You're right, Your Honor. I'm not going to contest that. That to the extent that the secured debt was paid down, that would mean the unsecured claim would also be paid down by $1 million. So that would presumably benefit the estate, but the problem was the estate was insolvent from the day that it started, and this certainly there was no benefit to her realized. And I don't think anyone's ever claim to the contrary, that that she would ever benefit by it. In fact, the calculus that was made here for the very beginning of this, right after the father's passing, was that she would never see a dime out of that estate. So there may be some theoretical aspect that, to the extent that the loan was paid down.
Although at the time he executed the assignment, that was by no means settled.
Well, not at all, because he was alive at that point, and so and no one really knew the extent of his debts. But he had substantial other debts, and not only that, the second wife, who was the administratrix of the estate, was able to persuade the under Georgia law to get a full year's of support right off the top out of the whatever assets there were in the estate. So there was just nothing left for my client. That's why we're here today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
Yeah, thank you, counsel.